Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In her book, Death Doula Eloa Arthur gives the job description. Be well-versed in the practicalities of preparing for death. Know the bureaucracy and legalities surrounding dead bodies. Sit bedside, hold hands, pay deep attention. Arthur says at the end of our lives, our bodies give away clues about the type of life we lived. So her book is about living as much as dying, and it's about her own life as much as any of the people she helped transition into death. She explains in the book that for almost 9 years she'd been practicing law at the Legal Aid Foundation in Los Angeles, but she hated it. She'd become deeply depressed, a house guest in her own body is how she describes it. And not really sure why or what she was looking for, she went to Cuba. That's where she met Jessica, on a bus.
Jessica was 36, and she was German, traveling to see the top 6 places in the world she wanted to see before she died because she had uterine cancer. And the ride with her, it was the most valuable conversation I've ever had.
I asked her if she wanted a family. What got in the way of her having one thus far? I asked her about her work, her lovers, her dreams, and her sorrows. Finally, I asked her about the end. What do you think death will be like?
And it also allowed me to see how hard it was for her to talk about her mortality with other people.
Jessica tells me this is the first time anyone has asked her these questions or wanted to listen to her talk about her death. Although her oncology program has paired her with a psychiatrist, he is only concerned with how she is living with the disease. He hasn't asked her about dying, nor have her family and friends made space for her to talk about this fundamental existential question. She says that whenever she talks about death, they encourage her to have hope, look on the bright side, and focus on healing.
It let me see how isolating it can be to be somebody who has a serious illness. But moreover, it allowed me to see the impact of talking about our mortality, how that can create gifts for us if we're willing to let it, because it created gifts for me in that I saw my life from the perspective of my death, and I didn't really like what I saw.
With all these thoughts rushing through my brain, my next question for Jessica is purely instinctive. When you look at yourself on your deathbed, who do you see? I see the scars from my surgeries. I see gray hair. I see my tattoos, age spots. I see a woman who didn't do what she wanted to do.
When we are adequately, appropriately, fully thinking about our death, we can't help but ask these questions about the big mystery. We ask the question about the meaning of our lives and the purpose and what the hell all this is for. All those questions are available when thinking about our death, but we have to be willing to look at it through that scope first. And many are unwilling. But in the presence of this stranger who was willing to go there with me, who answered the questions that other people would deem tactless or inappropriate, and by virtue of me having my walls and guards and ideas about what I should say or shouldn't say all the way down, we were able to journey into that really sacred and intimate place together.
Jessica opens her eyes and tells me how she always wanted to publish a book, to write something for herself. Then her eyes light up. She's had an idea. Maybe she would write a blog about this trip. Maybe that could be her book. She pulls out her notebook. Her words begin to flow out so fast that she can barely catch up with her own excitement.
I am leaning all the way in. I'm curious, I'm present, I'm lit up. And I don't have to think so much. I don't have to think about how I'm being or what I'm saying or what I'm doing. That self-consciousness that plagued me for a long time, trying to fit into a role that didn't work for me, trying to fit into a life that didn't match mine, necessarily forced me to constantly be looking and checking to see if I was doing it right all the time. With her, that went silent.
Jessica smiles to herself after one final sentence, then leans against the window. Her eyes flutter and her shoulders soften. The wrist holding the pen slackens and the pen falls out of her hand. Asleep, she looks so peaceful. I put on my headphones, beaming. Together, Jessica and I have stumbled onto something that can make her life feel more meaningful, a handle she can hold to pull herself closer to the life she's always envisioned. I feel more alive than I have in years. Talk of death is starting to bring me back to life.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alua Arthur is with us today. Her book is called Briefly, Perfectly Human. On that bus with Jessica, she says she started thinking about what she wants for her life, but also who she wants to be at her death. She makes it clear in the book, even though she has these hard-earned insights into grief and vulnerability and the questions we all have when we near the end of life, there are many things about death she will just never understand.
Many people believe I'm an expert, and I'm using air quotes around the word, yes, when talking about thinking about death. But I don't understand how you get to be an expert in something that you haven't done,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and something that there's no language for, and nobody can come back and teach me about it. Now, I've spent a lot of time with people that are dying, and by that, I mean we all have, in that each one of us is dying every single day. If only we take the deeper cut with humans and get to like the root of what's underlying all the rest of this, the only question and conversation that really matters, the one upon which all the rest lie, then we would all be versed in it. So I don't know more than the average person. I've collected some information about how to prepare, yet I will never know if it's useful until I'm done.
Yeah. A lot of this book is, I don't know, how do you describe it? I mean, part of it is a memoir, and I wonder if you always thought it would be that. I think some people may think, oh, this is Alua who's going to just talk mostly about what she's learned about death and being a companion for people, but it's much more than that. It's really grounded in your own personal story. Did you always intend to tell it that way?
I think when I started writing, it seemed pretty clear that that's what it was going to be. Part of my process was stories needed to come out. And so I started click, clack, clacking on my keyboard in the middle of the pandemic and saw the stories that came out. Some of them were about my clients, but some of them were also about my own life.
Yeah.
And I thought several things. For starters, it's really useful, I think, when we hear another human story to allow ourselves a much greater compassion across the board, because then we get to see this human for who they are, you know? Mm. I'd been not hearing as many of them, so I wanted to tell some of them. I wanted to tell mine. But lastly, I teach death doulas at Going With Grace, my company, and I noticed that when I tell stories, people seem to learn much better because they take from it what they will, as opposed to me telling them, this is what you need to know. If I can tell the story, they'll take what works for them, you know? Far be it from me to think that I know what's best for somebody else, but I can show you what I did and see if it helps you at all.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, well, maybe you're just entertained, and that's fine too.
Right. Well, we're entertained, I'll tell you that. I mean, and which gets us to the early part and this, well, as you put it, this death-defying flight, this experience when you're really young. Of course, your father was a member of parliament in Ghana, and there's this coup. And would you just sort of tell us about this, the memories you have, and tell us what's going on? Because it's important for us to know this before we sort of move on.
Yeah. When I was three, the government of Ghana, where I'm from, was overthrown in a military coup. My father was a member of parliament, and we lived at housing for the members of parliament. when the coup happened, the soldiers and the opposition came rushing to the building to gather up the members of parliament to take them off to prison. I think to kill some of them as well.
Yeah.
And when my parents heard that the coup was occurring, they snatched us all up and we fled. In that flight were my very first memories of the big glass blocks that are used for windows and seeing people outside shoving things into cars and people scurrying all about. And there was a lot of chaos, but through the chaos, I was holding my father's hand. We were running down the back stairwell. We lived on like the seventh floor or so. And we were running down the back stairwell to get to the car because the elevator was full of people. And I couldn't keep up. My dad picked me up. And I remember just looking over his shoulder and realizing that there was just trauma, chaos, like a lot going on. I didn't have any context for it at three. As an adult, it's very clear to me that what was happening was a lot of fear of death, people's fear for their lives, their safety. And in the midst of it all, I felt calm.
There's this other part of your character which comes out in the book, and it's what you describe as this near pathological fear of boredom, and your sense of perpetual unrest that lives in your spirit, as you say. Do you connect it to that experience, that sort of blurry experience when you were a child?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I want to, first of all, shout out my therapist through the whole writing process, because thank you. But also it helped me contextualize that my very first memories, you know, my early childhood experience was one of unrest. I felt calm with my dad, but we suddenly left our home not long after we left our country and moved to another country. My dad was in prison for a while. My mom was struggling to make ends meet. I had two other sisters. There was just like a lot of movement. And there is an element of how we get imprinted when we're really young. My imprint was of a chaotic time. And in the chaos, I felt calm. But also, as an adult, I seek like the big life experiences. You know, I'm just down. Like, let's go to festivals. Let's dance till 4 a.m. till my knees hurt. Get as much as we can out of this life. I think something in me was like, yes, 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 get it all. And some of it suits me very well for the work. I think it also suits me pretty good for life the way that I want to live it.
Yeah. But how does that square with the part of you that became an attorney?
It doesn't.
It doesn't, right? Yeah. So explain that.
Well, I wish I could.
Yeah.
You know, somehow we ended up there. And that somehow is that I was graduating college. And I'd been really active in social justice matters in college. And I knew I wanted to affect social change somehow, but I didn't know the way to do it. And my dad said, well, if you go to law school, you can do policy work. You can work with clients directly. You could go into politics. Like, you could do any number of things. A law degree is like one of those open degrees. And I thought it was a good idea. So I went to law school. And when I graduated, since I'd been doing HIV and AIDS work during law school and prior to law school, I wanted to find a way to continue that work in a way. And legal aid seemed to be a fit because it allowed me to do public services, big picture, and not just about HIV and AIDS work. But the practice of law is not a fit for me. It was very mundane. It was checking boxes, and I wanted to talk about what was just. I wanted to talk about healing, and I was curious about my clients and their stories and how they got here. And, you know, my favorite clients were the ones that revealed themselves wholly to me as I did to them, and to the extent that it was ethically safe to do so. But where we could actually connect on a really, really human level, I think I was most effective there for them, and they probably felt most seen and cared for in the process that way. But there is not space to do that in the practice. Like, it's not meant for that. It's transactional. Get in, get out. Yet, there was a part of it that felt aligned, which was the justice element, you know, which was the let's get in the trench and work with our fellow humans. The part of it that wasn't aligned were the systems that we were butting up against that would not budge. Yeah. You know, the same clients kept coming back over and over and over again. The way that the systems were set up do not feel as though they're set up for the people that they're meant to serve to succeed. It seems like it's meant to keep them in the position that they've always been in. And that frustrated me beyond measure. That was not a good fit. Like, there seemed to be nothing to do about it. It only became absolutely clear that I could not continue in the work when a psychiatrist said, you cannot go to work anymore.
Yeah.
That was the first time that I admitted that all that I'd been trying to do to make it work wasn't working. And it took a medical doctor to say it to me because I was so severely depressed that I couldn't continue to work.
Then you end up in Cuba. Then you meet Jessica. You say you don't believe in coincidences, but this is one of those moments of, well, how do you put it? Synchronicity. That's the thing you believe in, right?
Yeah. And it's only really easy to see how beautiful the synchronicity is in retrospect. With Jessica, I'd been running through the street to go do something else before I went to the bus stop, and a car almost hit me.
Yeah.
And I slammed my hands on the hood of the car and, you know, thought for a second, like, wow, like, don't die like this. It wasn't a fully baked thought. It was a very instinctive, like, I almost just died and this is not the way I want to go. And only much later, so on the bus, we have this conversation about death and dying. And only later did she reveal to me that she was in the car that had almost hit me on the street prior to me arriving at the bus stop.
Yeah.
And so deep in retrospect, I can see that that was a crash, a direct crash into what would end up becoming my life's work.
So Jessica gives you this moment, but it's Peter who taught you to be a death doula. Tell us about Peter. He's such an important part of your life and the story.
Peter St. John was my brother-in-law. He is my older sister, Busma St. John's husband. He was the brother that I didn't have. He constantly invited me into a higher version of myself than I saw. And he got sick. 6 months after I came back from Cuba, Peter was diagnosed with Burkitt's lymphoma. And at the time, it was like, oh, okay, he's sick, but he's going to be fine because, duh, people that you love don't die.
Yeah.
And then the doctors couldn't treat him. His cancer was spreading much faster than they could contain it. And 4 months later, his life was ending, although nobody said. I packed up. I went to New York to go visit and say hi and see how they were doing. And how they were doing was not great.
Yes. Yeah.
Not only was he very ill, there were so many tasks that needed doing, and there was so much grief and fear and sadness, but also some real beautiful moments of tenderness. And I stayed through the last 2 months of Peter's life, and I learned the work then and there. Without knowing it, I was acting as a death doula.
Well, I think this is the thing to really understand. So what you mean by that is, it wasn't that you were, you know, doing any rituals or doing necessarily any, you know, medical care. You were getting the stuff. You were picking up your niece. I think that's the thing that's really important to say is that, and I guess this is the thing you learned through Peter, is that that's what it was. It was the really practical things of being there when someone's going through that, I guess.
It was presence.
Huh.
It was presence. It was a, this is hard, and I'm not leaving. It was a, this sucks, and I feel it too. It was, these things need doing. Why don't you go be with him so I can do it? It was the witnessing of the whole process. It was adding some levity to the conversation, to the time. It was noticing the moments of beauty. Mm. It was about being there for it. You know, that's essentially the role of the doula. We are a non-medical, entirely non-medical, but holistic support person for the dying person and the circle of support through the entire process.
Alua Arthur. She's a death doula, author of the book Briefly, Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. She's also the founder of the organization Going with Grace. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have Elua Arthur with us today. She's a death doula, sometimes called a death midwife, and it is what it sounds like. They assist someone who's dying. In her book, Arthur writes about her job and her life. She says, dying is a process of transformation of the body, and she's learned our bodies tell our story. The book is called Briefly, Perfectly Human. You say in the book that the things we hide in life come out in death. Say what you mean.
Well, I've heard my fair share of secrets.
Yeah.
I've heard a whole lot of secrets, and they will go with me to my grave. Yeah. Because the element of trust and confidentiality does sit at the core of the role. But I find that, you know, when people try to hold on to things throughout their lives, and I don't only mean secrets, but I also mean things that they loved or cared about, it gets clear as they're dying. As we're dying, we're leaving everything here. You know, we're leaving the people that we loved and the things that we did that we enjoyed. Mm. And I find that people gravitate toward those things more in their dying, and so it becomes more apparent. Maybe a big example, but a client who was closeted for most of his life and in his dying finally admitted that his roommate was his partner. Yeah. And openly behaved like that in front of family members finally. Now, that is huge, huge. Mm. But it was his dying that allowed him to openly be who he actually was. That's a bigger example, but also smaller things like our lack of capacity to allow somebody to take care of us or our unwillingness to be vulnerable. Those are similar. Or, you know, just any parts of ourselves, the masks that we wear while we're living, they break down in illness and certainly in our dying.
You write that if we're practiced saying the scary thing or owning the shitty thing, what you're saying there is don't wait. We should start to reconcile the relationships before we get to that point. And one of the things you do is you suggest kind of imagining ourselves, looking at ourselves on our deathbed and imagining like who's there and who's not there. Explain that more, would you?
I find that so often at the deathbed, people are then trying to do the things to heal their relationships and in their lives. And this is also part of the things that go unsaid when we're living that show up in our dying. I think it's wildly important for us to be in the practice of our I love yous, thank yous, forgive me's, I'm sorry's, you amaze me, all those. I think we need to regularly be in the practice, because when we don't, and we die with things unsaid or things unheard, that has an impact on those that continue to live. Mm. One of those areas where it shows up the most is in our personal relationships. There's been a whole host of clients that have been scurrying to clean up their relationships and they're dying when there's no more time. And we have this terrible, terrible image from idea from Hollywood where, tell me if you've seen this before. Dad is dying. Yep. He's in the hospital, hooked up to all the machines, and his heart rate is slowing. And then all of a sudden, his son comes rushing through the doors, hair disheveled, suit askew. He was on a red eye running through the halls. And he's like, Dad, I'm sorry, I loved you. And Dad says, I always loved you, son. And then he flatlines, and that's it, you know? And they finally said the things. Well, it does not look like that in real life at all. Not only are people not conscious often, but the capacity, the energy to have these conversations is significantly diminished right before death. And so we have to practice them beforehand. But so many people think about their deathbed, and there are people that they want there that aren't there because of their current state of relationship to them, because they haven't said that I'm sorry's or I love you's or whatever, any of the things that the son was rushing in to say last minute. Mm-hmm. Most people don't get that chance. And so we have to start now. Hmm.
Do you mind saying the three major questions you found over the years that people who are near the end of life always have?
Yeah. Those questions are, who did I love? How have I loved? And was I loved?
This gets to what you say is the sort of the legacy that we leave. Talk to us a little bit about how you think about a legacy, which you say can be big or can be small. And it gets to this moment that you write about in the book about this woman who dies and her surviving children wrote this obituary that you read. This wasn't a client or anything like that. It was just something that you had read. And the obituary was just totally brutal. Will you talk about that story?
Yeah. So in the book, I write a little bit about a client whose kids just eviscerate, like just took her down in the obituary. She doesn't sound like she's a very good mom. And it sounds like they also didn't really like the type of human that she was. And they made it absolutely known and seen.
Well, you include the piece, some of it in the book. It says, we celebrate her death from this earth.
Yes.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to read that.
Yeah.
I don't think. But it was their truth. And they presumably knew her best. I think it's important that we tell the whole truth about somebody, the whole truth about who they were in their dying. We make saints out of people after they die, and I don't understand why. Mm. What we end up doing is we end up pushing the grief of the people that felt that about that person aside. Like, if you thought that she was not a saint, then your grief is not as important. It's entirely disenfranchised. It stays over there. We have no space for it because she was a saint, even though her kids say not. We're leaving a legacy every single day with every word, with every action, every inaction, which is also really important. Mm-hmm. Every inaction also leaves a legacy. And it's our legacy, while for some it is about their bank accounts or their names on the side of a building, for many, many, many others, it's about our kindness or how compassionate we were or how greedy we were or how smart we were. How often we showed up for other people, how generous we were. You know, those are the things that come up.
Yeah. Would you talk about this experience that you write about that kind of, as you say in the book, it forced you to your edges and boundaries in your work? It's a man named Jack, a raging racist.
And I'm Black.
And you're Black. And he did not like that you showed up. Will you talk about this moment?
Yeah. Jack's sons invited me to come help them negotiate a disagreement about whether or not Jack should continue to get pain medication. And I was absolutely clear with them that I am not a medical provider. I don't quite know what's happening with Jack's body when it comes to the pain medication, but they wanted my support. So I agreed to go, and when I arrived, I learned outside the house before we walked in that their father, Jack, with whom we were talking about, was a racist. And they did not think it important to tell me that before I came. In fact, they waited till I'd already driven an hour and a half from LA to tell me, which really, I mean, it's so problematic for many different reasons, but mostly that they wanted something from me, and the only way for them to get it was to hide parts of this element so that they could get it, and also hide a key component, which is that being in that space with a man that hates people that wear my skin is violent to me in nature. They were just going to do it anyway because they got something from it. Yeah. I will just make a brief aside here, and that is absolutely whiteness at its most opportunistic through centuries. That aside, I agreed to support because I plan to support the two of them, the brothers, in their conversation about their father. And we talked plenty, but I still wasn't getting the root of the issue, because one son thought that he should not have any more pain medication because he wasn't in pain, I'm using air quotes, and also he didn't want him to get addicted. And then the other son thought, well, give him whatever he wants anyway because he's dying, and who are we to judge about whether or not he's in pain? The part about Jack not feeling any pain physically wasn't clear to me, and so I wanted to talk to Jack a little bit to see where his head was at about his pain medication. And that was against my better judgment, because Jack hated people who look like me. And it was obvious right off the bat that he had no interest in me being in his house, that he thought that I didn't know what I was talking about. What became clear was that Jack was, he had, first of all, he'd been addicted to opiates after he came back from the Korean War. And when he was talking about pain medication, he kept talking about his opiates, that he wanted his opiates, which was different to me than like pain medication or relief or I'm hurting so much. He just kept saying, I want my opiates. I felt strongly as though Jack was medicating the pain of his dying. I don't mean the physical pain, but the emotional and existential pain through opiate use. And I shared that with his sons and left them to their decision making. And of course, after Jack learned that his sons had agreed to give him more pain medication, he said I was a sweet girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you say after that, after Jack, you never accepted another client whose beliefs included hate. You said, I won't do that to myself again, which I found, I think, important to say because, again, you have to have your own edges and boundaries, I guess.
Right. Which is why it's really, really important that people who are doing this work also learn how to take care of themselves. And taking care of ourselves also includes being really clear on what our boundaries are.
There's this important idea that you write about in the book about surrendering to help and the kind of intimacy of death. And you tell your own experience. You're visiting a friend, Kristen, in Colorado. I mean, you were sick. You'd lost a lot of weight. And you write about this experience of having to learn to sort of surrender for help. And you say some of us go our entire lives without doing that. And you say that also that part of what you're doing as a death doula is you describe it as being this message in a bottle that awashes, you know, that washes ashore for people, telling them it's never too late to actually ask for help. So will you talk about the importance of this?
Yeah. I think by virtue of the system that we live in, we are meant to be able to handle all things on our own. And if we can't, we can pay for it. And we need more money to do so. Whereas in a lot of other cultures, we're meant to be living communally, where I do not know, cannot possibly handle all things myself, and other people must help. And it's okay for them to do so. And it's a natural give and receive. We don't have to pay money for somebody to come and do this. And the person's only doing the thing because of what we can pay them, but rather because we live in community and every member fills a role within that community. In those communities, I think it's much easier for people to ask for the help that they need because it's not seen as a deficit or fault of their own that they don't have it. Rather, it's filled naturally by the members of the community. In our society, in this largely capitalistic one, it's seen as a fault when we cannot do or have all the things that we're supposed to have. There's a great American story about the people that pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They did it all on their own. Yeah. They created these fortunes on their own. They never remember the people that let them pay their rent late, or who let them use a bathroom in a coffee shop where they didn't have money to pay for the coffee first, or Wi-Fi that they got someplace, or the person that jumped their car when their battery died. You know, we must learn how to rely on other people. We're interdependent beings. We must learn how to rely on other people, but it requires us to surrender to this idea that we don't got it all. And that is so hard for many of us to do. We have this facade of being strong, I'm using air quotes, and of, you know, being the smartest and the brightest and the fastest and the best, and I don't need anybody for anything, but actually you do. And it becomes absolutely clear when people are dying that they need somebody. I think that the more that we practice allowing somebody else to fill our needs, well, first identifying what our needs are, next practice speaking out them out loud, and third, allowing somebody to fill them, the easier ride we'll have in our dying time when we are disabled and cannot handle our needs on our own anymore and need some support to do everything that we used to be able to do on our own.
There's this story you tell about one of your clients, Claudia. She had this, you describe it as this toxic self-reliance. And this is something that rears its head near the deathbed. You know, it's the thing, I guess, like, I don't want to be a burden. But how do you talk to them about that feeling? Because we use the word toxic. So how do you talk to them about just surrendering to that?
Well, often what is revealed, well, it's often revealed in a moment of tenderness when somebody says, well, I don't want to be a burden on other people. And through some exploration, we can determine what they're so afraid of needing other people for. What does it say about them if they do need somebody? Yeah. And often it's that they are not worthy of it, that people won't show up for them, that they are not loved, that they have to do things for people to care about them or to do something for them. And none of those things are true. We are inherently worthy by virtue of being born. It is our birthright to get the support of other people, to get the care and love of other people. It's kind of baked into how this whole life thing happens anyway. You know, you're cooked in a womb, it comes out, somebody takes care of you until you can start taking care of yourself. And then hopefully, as you get older, the people that brought you in or those people that are older than you who then need the care, you then turn the care onto them. It's kind of baked into how the thing goes. And yet this idea of being a burden is so weighty on some that they will go to lengths to avoid needing anybody or surrendering into receiving the care. And yet, when we receive, we give. And when we give, we receive. It's an energetic cycle that we block by saying, no, thank you, I don't need your help, or I don't want your help, rather.
Ilua Arthur, she's a death doula. Her book is Briefly, Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the death doula, Ilua Arthur. Her book is called Briefly, Perfectly Human. I want to ask about Summer, one of your clients. I was really sad about the story, as a lot of people will be, of course. She's 26, had late detected and terminal breast cancer. You come to know her just 3 months before she dies. And one of the things you write about, and this had not occurred to me, is that ageism is rampant in death care and in grief. She's only 26. What do you mean by that, by this ageism? Talk to us about that.
Almost all of the language about people with illness and dying are older people.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll find if you're 40-something and you have cancer, the support groups are older people, or that people talk about dying in terms of being older and living a long, full life. They're rarely talking about the young folks because there isn't space for them in it. Mm. And it shows up in a way that's really unfair to the younger folks because there's not space for them. Or people think, you know, oh, you shouldn't have to deal with this right now. And it's like, nobody should have to deal with this at any point. And yet we do. Young people get sick and die all the time. But it directly confronts our ideas about how dying should happen. I'm using air quotes again.
Yeah.
When young people get sick and die. But children do as well. And that is a tough one for folks to take in. Summer really made it very clear. She approached her dying in a way that taught me a lot about the value that I placed on the years that she had lived, the 26 years that she had lived, as opposed to somebody who was like 86. You know, she still had furniture from Craigslist, and I'd hope that she had a chance to buy a real couch.
Yeah.
You know, one that nobody owned before. But first of all, what privilege. And next, this is all Summer got access to. And that is okay. That was her entire life.
Summer was raised evangelical Christian like you. And she like you, left the church. But at this point in her life, as she's dying, you help her choose which parts of Christianity that she wants to keep, because she wants to keep some. Talk a little bit about this, if you would, because you mentioned that the deathbed is the most important time for what's most pressing on our hearts to take center stage. Will you talk about that?
Yeah. As we are dying, people are also, as you can imagine, concerned about what, if anything, comes after we die.
Yeah.
And so people's belief system, it starts to get tested. I mean, beliefs are just ideas and theories And they only become facts once there's evidence. And we're about to get the evidence, whether or not we'll be conscious for it. I don't know. But people start to think a lot about their belief system in their dying time. One of those areas is around religion. And with Summer, it was helpful for us to dig through what she'd come to believe about what would happen after she died and where she got it from. And Christianity was a huge one, as it is for many, many of us. As you mentioned, I was raised an evangelical Christian after my father came out of prison. He and my mom became missionaries, and we traveled around the world spreading the good word of Jesus for a few years until we traveled for quite a few years, but yeah. I only carried on in my body and my spirit until I started to ask a lot of questions about Christianity and realized that a lot of parts of it didn't really align with what I personally believe. And Summer had been through a similar journey herself, and yet in her dying was starting to think about the parts that she still wanted to hold on to. And she didn't want to be wrong about going to heaven and maybe sitting on the right-hand side of the Father, as we're taught. And so she wanted to get baptized. So in the 11th hour, just a couple of days before she died, a priest came out and baptized Summer. Mm. And that's how Summer chose to go out as a Christian, baptized, accepting Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior. And I celebrate that for her.
Yeah. It's interesting that you, even though you have your own sort of point of view about that, that you celebrated her decision to get baptized there at the end. And you say the way I doula places secularity at its core. So I guess you have to, restrain yourself?
I think I just celebrate how anything that they find that brings them some peace.
Yeah.
There was a client. Yeah, because it's a big unknown, you know? Yeah. And they're about to find out. Like, Yikes.
Right.
But there was a client of mine years ago who started talking about her concept of God, I'm using air quotes, and believed that God was an I in the sky. Now, I thought she meant the letter I, like the I am, or the I that in some non-dual perspectives underwrites us all, the I that lives within us all. But no, she meant an eyeball.
Yeah.
I was surprised and shocked and a little tickled. Like, wait, what? So it's like looking at us all the time. Does it have lashes? Like, what is going on? But that was her belief system. And it intrigues me because people come up with all sorts of things and I'm just down. Like, if it brings you some peace, please go for it. Please go for it. Mm.
Elua, I wanted to ask you about how you are present when someone dies. You write that when you enter the room where dying is imminent, you pause before walking in. Why?
Well, I got to center myself first. Mm-hmm. You know, ground. I was probably sitting in traffic because I'm always late. So I got to put that behind. I want to remind myself that whatever I'm going to meet in there will change me. That the person that walks in is not going to be the same person that walks out. But I will walk out. And so I want to remind myself also as I cross that threshold that what I encounter there is not mine to keep, that I'm going to experience it there. I don't have to keep it. I don't have to carry it. It's not mine to take forward. It's a useful ritual. It's useful for me anyway to give myself a little bit of latitude and space in this work and to be able to continue doing it. As if I kept all that I witnessed, it would probably feel heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But instead, it can feel joyful when we get to celebrate the humaning that's happening as well.
You touch the door frame.
Yeah. Simply. Cross the threshold and cross right back.
And there's a mantra. Do you want to say something about that?
May I speak truth. May I speak love. May I be my highest blessing.
What is the liminal space people are dying? What is that? Where do they go there?
Into the middle part.
Huh.
Not yet living, but kind of.
Yeah.
And not yet dead. It's that juicy, juicy, juicy place where there is likely no more words or actions, where the body systems have started to shut down, where we know dying will be imminent, but nobody yet knows when. It could be hours, it could be days, it could be weeks. But in that space where the old is dying off and the new is coming, if anything at all.
You say you can feel the shift in energy at that moment?
Majorly. Yeah. Big time. If you've ever been in the room, you know what I'm talking about. It feels different. There is something profound occurring. It's hard to put words to.
Yeah. You say near the end of the book that if there was one question that you yourself could ask, you know, the creator or God or whatever it is that's out there, that question would be, why?
I place my curiosity at the center of my humaning. And the why question always has led space for wow. Like when I'm thinking about why is it like this, I often feel such awe when an answer is revealed, or there's even awe baked into the asking because I'm curious about what it is that's happening. I wonder if, big if, all of this is a projection of our consciousness. Why would we pick traffic? Why taxes?
Yeah.
Like, why bombs? Why murder and rage and rape? Why? I don't have answers, obviously. The other side of that equation is, you know, why love? Mm. Why joy? Why tears of joy? Why do we sometimes start crying when we see somebody that we love that we haven't seen for a long time?
Yeah.
Why all of those? And I don't know that I actually want an answer.
Mm.
I like to revel in the mystery of it because it creates space for wonder.
You mentioned that we can all sort of choose to anticipate our deaths in the same way that we are, you know, anticipating going on this cool trip. And we can kind of add these sensory details. Is it like an exercise you're imagining we could go through?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It is one that we should, to the extent that we can, do. You know, I want to couch all of this, and this probably should have been said much earlier on, but being able to think about our mortality in this way is an absolute privilege,
yeah.
A major one, because there are millions that don't ever get the chance. They're just trying to get their basic needs met,
right.
And also maybe trying not to have bombs dropped on them, you know.
Yep.
One way to begin this conversation is to think about the needs of ours that are met currently and the sense of safety that we currently feel in our bodies and in our spirit and in our emotional bodies. And if any of those things feel like they're not true, I do not suggest that people engage in the quest to think about their mortality.
Mm.
But considering what you want your final moments to be like, how you want to leave, what you want to leave of you behind, allows you to see very clearly what it is that you value, what you've made of your time here, what you still want to experience, and allows more space for wonder, if we're open to it. If we have the capacity to do it. And I suggest that if you do, like all of us that carry privilege, use it and use it very, very wisely and use it hopefully in the direction of good.
Can we end with Ms. Bobby? This was just a few years after you had started your death work practice. She was 94 years old in an elder care facility in Los Angeles. And in these conversations with her that you write about in the book, you say you'd kind of been hoping for what you call, you know, some kind of magic quote to ease your own sense of doubt and fear about what you were doing with your life. Will you talk about this story? Did you find the magic quote?
Yes, I did, but not in the way that I expected.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in the way that, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, like why a memoir as opposed to a prescriptive book or something like that. I think many of us look at the dying like, oh, dying saint, teach me all of your ways. And that's not fair. They're still human, you know.
Yep.
And I was certainly doing that to Miss Bobby. Like, yes, teach me everything, wise elder, soon to be ancestor. And Miss Bobby just kind of dismissed it very quickly. And she said, I don't know shit.
Yeah.
I don't know anything, but it was one hell of a ride. And that is a magic quote. Is that her life was really messy, but it was one hell of a ride. What else can we ask for?
Ayla Arthur, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. This has been fun.
Ayla Arthur. She's a death doula, author of the book Briefly, Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. She's also the founder of the organization Going with Grace. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.